Kushner versus Department of Employment Security.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Joy Lockerbie, along with co-counsel Thomas Gerard, for the appellant and the claimant in this case, Ms. Sarah Kristner, who's in court today. I'd like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Your Honors, this case is important. The record shows that there is no disqualifying misconduct at issue here. The commissioner erred in denying unemployment benefits to Ms. Kristner, and this court should reverse and award unemployment benefits for two main reasons. First, the commissioner misinterpreted and misapplied the law when he found that Washington Center for Pain Management's two-week notice policy constituted behavior that the employer has a right to expect under 50 RCW 50.04.2941B. Second, the commissioner erred in finding misconduct when, on the whole, the record lacks substantial evidence to support a finding under 1B by a preponderance of the evidence. For the first time in this court, respondent has alleged that there were false pretenses in how Ms. Kristner's job ended, and that is a mischaracterization of the facts, and this short should not entertain that new argument for the first time on appeal. Not every employment policy that an employer promulgates to its employees becomes a standard of behavior that the employer has the right to expect under 1B.
And what case are you relying on that? Because as I read 1B, it's very broad.
Well, Your Honors, I haven't found any cases that exactly define 1B. This is a new issue for the court. But the statute itself, the misconduct statute, is to be read in a whole. And to determine whether the employer had a right to expect 2 weeks' notice, it's necessary to compare 2F, which is the reasonable policy requirement, along with 1B. So 1A talks about the first part of the statute talks about how misconduct is defined. The second part of the statute gives the per se definitions. And then the third part of the statute are the exceptions.
So I want to make sure I understand. So is appellant contending you can only find 1B if it's tied into a subsequent per se violation? Is that the position? I wasn't clear.
Okay, I'll explain and answer your question. So the standard under 1B is interpreted by the Employment Security Department in their benefit policy guide, also called the Unemployment Insurance Resource Manual. And they define it as behavior that doesn't require notice. It doesn't require a warning. It could be that a policy could fall under 1B, but not necessarily. And so in this case, we have an employer who has a policy that's very aspirational in nature. It's something, you know, they would desire to have Ms. Kristner to give 2 weeks' notice off before requesting time off for work, whether it be for her service in the Army Reserves, for medical reasons, or for personal reasons, for looking for another job and to better herself. But just because the employer has a policy does not mean that then it falls under the 1B section. The commissioner actually affirmed as corrected the administrative law judge's findings and just fitted under 1B. And so the reason why this is really important is because if this court affirms this case on that basis, then employers can just craft aspirational type policies that are performance based and then be relieved of benefit charges, because then they can ask the individual to resign, which is what happened here. The Employment Security Department adjudicates that job separation as a discharge, and then the employer could be relieved of benefit charges because there will be a finding of misconduct.
I'm still trying to understand this. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't we have to reverse this decision, wouldn't we have to find that the policy itself was not reasonable somehow?
Your Honor, you don't have to find reasonableness here, and the reason why is because the commissioner did not analyze reasonableness, nor did the administrative law judge. There was no finding of fact or conclusion of law about the reasonableness of the policy. So that's not the basis for why the commissioner denied benefits. It was they excluded the whole reasonableness analysis, and that's why it's important, because we have a pro se claimant who's representing herself at this hearing. She does not need then to just, you know, be ambushed at the hearing and be able to try to prove her case because it doesn't fit under the standard. And again, I think this goes back to the fact that the policy itself is aspirational in nature and performance-based, and there needs to be exceptions for a two-week notice policy. So in this case, the employer said, you can give 2 weeks notice whenever possible. Ms. Christner did that. She was honest all the time about the reasons that she requested for time off, and the employer excused all of the absences. It was only after she informed them in writing that she was looking for another position and wanting to better herself in her career of law enforcement that they said, you know, we're no longer going to accommodate this. And then prior to that, a few weeks before she had written that last email, they told her it was a no exceptions policy. So they singled her out and made the policy only against her, and it wasn't consistently applied to other employees. So the statute is clear and not ambiguous. The misconduct statute it clearly lays out what needs to be considered, 1, 2, and 3, and here the exceptions apply. Ms. Christner, even if there was some kind of finding that there was a substantial evidence in the record that there was misconduct, there's simply no way that she could have not fallen under one of the exceptions here. Additionally, with the commissioner erred in failing to consider the substantial evidence in the record in making the final decision, because there's a lot of information here that is just not in the record. For example, the employer failed to provide dates and details of any of the alleged absences. And we're talking about 5 to 6 absences here, but we don't know how much notice Ms. Christner gave. We don't know the reason that she gave. The testimony at the hearing just fell short of any real standard of what would be required in a typical case. And normally an employer would prove this information by providing it to the Employment Security Department. And I see I'm out of time, so I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Leah Harris. I represent the Employment Security Department. The court should affirm the commissioner's decision because the record, viewed in the light most favorable to that decision, supports the conclusion that Ms. Christner deliberately disregarded the standards of behavior her employer had the right to expect of her.
And what exact standard was it?
Well, the employer had the right to expect her to be at work for her scheduled shifts and to give sufficient notice when she needed time off. And they made this expectation known to her, both through its written policy, asking for 2 weeks' notice when possible, and through conversations they had with Ms. Christner and a written warning they provided to her on September 26 about the frequency of her requests and the difficulty they were having in accommodating all of those requests. And more importantly, they made known to her how challenging it was to accommodate those requests on short notice to find front desk coverage.
Does the record reflect that she was sort of singled out on this as opposed to having the same policy for all similarly situated employees?
No, the record does not support that she was singled out.
The question I have is the procedure here seems a little odd. I mean, they asked her to resign, and she submitted a resignation. Then the initial determination by the department is you're entitled to benefits. Then the employer appeals. The employer comes to the hearing without a lawyer. She doesn't have a lawyer at the hearing. The ALJ sort of makes the case by cross-examining her. You know, so how many times did you miss? And it just isn't that sort of. I mean, how much notice did she really have of what it was she's going to end up being penalized for?
Well, the notice of hearing did say that the issues at the hearing would be whether you were discharged for misconduct under RCW 50-20066 or voluntarily quit without good cause. And she went there trying to prove that she was, in fact, discharged. These hearings are informal. The parties are often, if not more often than not, unrepresented. And so it is the job of the trier of fact to gather all the facts, try to figure out how the job separation occurred. And, of course, you know, the fact finder cannot adopt the employer's misunderstanding of the law as a conclusion of law. Even after the conversations and the warning that they provided to Ms. Christner, she continued to make frequent requests for time off, often with short notice. And as she testified, her own testimony, she said that during this time period, most of her requests for time off were for Department of Corrections interviews.
That's after September 26th when the email comes. We don't really know about before then.
She said her testimony was during this time period, so probably during the warnings. I mean, I think there's a reasonable inference from the progression of the testimony and the questions from the ALJ that during this time period, during the warnings, that most of her requests for time off, and in her own email to the employer on October 18th, she said, increasingly, my need for time off is to pursue other employment.
Is a warning required under this statute?
No. The only time a warning is required is for, I think, inexcused tardiness, and that's under one of the per se disqualification provisions under subsection 2. And so that demonstrates that prior warnings that your job may be in jeopardy is not required in order to establish misconduct.
And is the misconduct here the less than 2 weeks or the repetitive nature, or I'm trying to figure out what exactly is the basis for the misconduct?
I think it's sort of the totality of the circumstances, the time-consuming, so, I mean, clearly it's not misconduct to take time off for medical appointments or to look for another job, but when that job search becomes so time-consuming that it puts a burden on your employer to accommodate your request for time off and find coverage, they tell you it's a challenge, you know it's a challenge, and you know that they believe that all of your requests are for medical appointments, yet you continue to make frequent requests with sort of vague explanations. She said personal matter. The employer testified that sometimes she would call it an emergency situation. Then you've disregarded the standards of behavior the employer has the right to expect of you, which is be at work for your scheduled shift, give adequate notice for time off, and be upfront about your need for time off. Don't request time off knowing they think it's medical appointments when you know it's not.
Isn't there a distinction between misconduct as it's used in 5020.066 and what happened here? I mean, misconduct, you tend to think of somebody breaking the rules in the workplace. This is much, seems to be a lesser thing. It's just that I have certain expectations of my employees. You failed you disregarded those expectations. Are those the same thing? I mean, was she really put on notice of what it was she was going to have to defend against when she showed up for this hearing? I mean, the misconduct really sounds very different than what we're talking about.
Well, it is broader and more inclusive, but the legislature specifically provided for that
in
subsection 1B.
Well, different statutory sections, and she did not get notice of 2941B.
And that's just the definition of misconduct. 5020.066 is the disqualification statute, which says you're disqualified if you've been discharged for misconduct connected with your work. She didn't have specific notice of the definition, mm-hmm. but as we discussed in our briefing, you know, even a criminal information does not have to include the definition of elements of a crime.
But it does have to set out the elements of the crime, and the elements of this particular crime were not set out for her, were they? Did she know what she was going to have to defend against when she showed up?
She did not. She hadn't been provided a copy of the statute, but she probably would have been provided. And this is not in the record, but every unemployment benefits claimant gets a pamphlet about how to prepare for your case. And it does cite to all the relevant statutory provisions, both for voluntary quit and for misconduct.
So going back to this broad statute, there's really no cases interpreting it, are there?
There is not a case specifically interpreting 1B. The definition does adopt prior case law prior to, I think, the 2006 amendment, more particularly defining misconduct. And so there are older cases based on those more general or broader definitions of misconduct under subsection 1.
Would it have to be a reasonable policy? I mean, or can it just be any policy?
Well, in this case, the commissioner didn't make a specific finding about the policy. It wasn't that she violated the policy requiring 2 weeks. It was, again, sort of the totality of her conduct. Frequent short notice requests, not always upfront about the reasons for those requests, knowing the employer believed they were all for medical reasons, and just the frequency and the burden of the frequency of the requests on the employer to find coverage and then continuing to do it nonetheless. And so that is a violation of the standard of behavior, not the specific policy requiring 2 weeks. The commissioner did not find she committed misconduct under subsection 2F.
Was there a policy about 2 weeks' notice? Was that a written policy, something that was handed out to each employee that worked at this?
It was a written policy, and Ms. Christner read that policy into the record as part of her testimony, so she can't reasonably dispute its existence. Given the fault-based principles underlying the Employment Security Act, the deferential standard of review, the department asks the court to affirm the ALJ, commissioner, and superior court's conclusion that the record supports a finding of misconduct. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
So I'd first like to start with explaining in more detail what the distinction is between 1B and 2F. So under 1B, under the benefit policy guide, behavior that rises to the level of a standard of behavior that an employer has the right to expect would include things like reporting to work under the influence of illegal drugs, stealing from the employer, even having an outburst at work, leaving work without giving any notice at all. And we simply don't have that here. Ms. Christner had good faith, gave her employer every reasonable opportunity to let them know that she was looking for time off. The respondent is incorrect that most of the reasons were to look for other jobs. Ms. Christner testified, and it's in the record, that most of the reasons were for medical reasons. And we're talking about 5 to 6 instances, and of those, most of them were medical. So that means 1 or 2 were to look for jobs. But Ms. Christner...
Well, wasn't that 5 to 6 instances between September 26th and the date in October? So that would be like 5 times in a 3-week period.
The record is actually very unclear about that. So the employer at the hearing did not provide any specific dates or details of these alleged absences and didn't provide any details about the reason for the absences. And what's really important here is that the employer failed to provide information to the Employment Security Department at the initial fact-finding level. And had they done so, then Ms. Christner would have had an opportunity to be more on notice about what would be charged against her. But then when she received the notice of appeal, the notice of appeal only lists the 5020.066 statute on there. It doesn't have the actual definition of misconduct. Had she had that, she would have at least had an opportunity as a per se person to say, okay, there might be something more at issue here. But 066.
I understand that argument. Was that, and she wasn't represented at that hearing, but in the appeal to the Superior Court, was that argument on lack of notice made?
No, Your Honor. But that goes to a due process issue, which can be made before this court. Additionally, with the 1B policy, it's not a catch-all. It's not that the Employment Security Department can then put anything in there and then just disregard the reasonableness standard. It has to rise to that level that it's more egregious conduct where no notice or warning is required because it's just common sense. Someone who commits that behavior is going to be discharged, and that's misconduct under 1B. And the reason why it's super important that an employer not be allowed to use a subjective performance expectation policy is because then they can use it as a pretext to terminate someone for misconduct under 1B, be relieved of charges, benefit charges, and not show reasonableness. We ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.